Hello and welcome to The Culture Bunker, your pop culture podcast roundup. I'm Andrew Harrison.
And I'm Sian Patterson. Today, yes she can. This week, the Marvel Cinematic Universe expands to take in Ms. Marvel, featuring the first Muslim superhero from their stable. Is it any good?
And breathe. We'll be talking to Balearic behemoth Colleen Cosmo Murphy about the resurgence of Chill Out.
Plus, we own this city. We own this city. Oh, no, not that one. We look at the new series from the showrunners behind Baltimore cop epic The Wire. Police and thieves? More later.
All this and more on today's Culture Bunker.
Welcome to the Culture Bunker. Let's say hello to our first guest. The crowd say Cosmo Selector. I know it's terrible. New York to London transplant Colleen Cosmo Murphy has been a radio host and DJ and selector since the age of 14, and today hosts Balearic Breakfast, Cosmodelica, and Classic Album Sundays worldwide on Worldwide FM. She also wrote, co-produced, and hosted the Classic Album Sundays series This Woman's Work, Sounds of a City series on BBC Six Music, and Turntable Tales on BBC Radio 4. She has DJed everywhere and put together numerous compilations of her own, and her latest is the extremely relaxed Balearic Breakfast Volume 1. And it's out 10th of June. Hello, Colleen.
Hello.
How are you?
I'm doing well, thank you. A bit warm, but cooling down as I'm sitting here with you.
Yeah, we'll heat up later. As a producer, you've remixed for Rasheen Murphy, The Rapture, Lady Blackbird, Candy Staten, and many more. Has the art of the remix changed over the years, or is it still basically the same nuts and bolts?
I think it's changed in the fact that there's so many. You know, sometimes I feel like we have too many remixes, too many records out. I mean, the good thing about music nowadays is that it is so democratic that people can put out their own music on Bandcamp, produce things in their own homes. But it also makes it a hugely crowded territory. So it's very hard to kind of stick out. And when I started getting back into remixing, I guess it was the beginning of the pandemic, I had taken a break for a few years. I wanted to do something that was vocal related because I do feel vocal songs and with memorable hooks and great choruses that you can sing along to is something that people can grasp a bit more. So that's kind of my philosophy at the moment. I'm mainly doing remixes of just vocal records. But, you know, the art of the remix is an important thing. I mean, you want, if you have a great single out there, you want it to appeal to a lot of different types of DJs and different scenarios. Mm-hmm. So hence, that's why the art of the remix is still alive and kicking.
And especially over lockdown, people did want to dance, whether it was in the kitchens or not.
I kept dancing so much, you know, in my own home. When I was streaming all my radio shows, I was also doing it with video, with a few cameras and green screen and doing it on Mixcloud Live and Twitch TV. And, you know, I'm a DJ. Of course, I'm used to being on one side of the turntables, but I started as a dancer, you know? Yeah, I think a lot of DJs, I think especially a lot of female DJs actually started dancing first. Mm.
You can't DJ if you can't dance. That's what I think.
I like that. I like that. I don't want to say that because there's a few DJs I know who can't.
But I don't believe that.
No names. Who is the most fun to remix for? Who will say, do what the hell you like?
They all do.
Really?
Actually, yeah, they all do. My new philosophy on remixing is to save myself a lot of trouble. And if I don't have an idea the first time I hear it, I move on. So I've turned down a lot of remixes just for that reason. I like the song, but I feel the song is the best that it can be, and I couldn't really do anything with my kind of vibe that would make it any better, that would enhance it in any way. So I have turned down just as many as I've accepted. Mm-hmm. But yeah, it's if I don't hear it in the first listen, it's a pass for me.
That makes sense, though. You work with former Captain Beefheart guitarist Gary Lucas on your project Wild Rumpus. Would Beefheart have made a good remixer?
Oh my gosh. Only if he was adding vocals. I think he could do so. I think he would be a great person if he had an instrumental remix. Don Van Vliet would be a fantastic person to add a whole new kind of vocal to it, some poetry, if you will. What a legend, an absolute legend.
I'd look forward to Beefheart Bangers.
That's the album title
there
already.
There you go, Beefheart Bangers.
Beefheart Bangers.
Beyond the
like
grave.
It.
Yes.
Who else is with us? Andrew Harrison?
Also joining us today is a Culture Bunker OG. Clark Collis is senior writer for Entertainment Weekly in the USA, but in past lives, he worked on something called Select Music Magazine. He was also the co-founder of Neon, the fantastic film magazine, and he likes to spend sunny days like this sitting indoors watching movies in the dark, so he gets a thumbs up from us. Clark is also the author of You've Got Red on You, the ultimate behind-the-scenes making of Shaun of the Dead, which is coming out in paperback in September. Hi, Clark. Welcome back.
Thank you so much for having me.
It's always a delight. So what's latest on the Clark Entertainment beat then?
Well, it's a few weeks ago now, but I went to the Top Gun Maverick junket in San Diego, and Entertainment Weekly has this, as you know, what we call a rubric called Three Rounds With, basically. Mm. So we do, three rounds of, it can be three rounds of cupcakes, but it's always best if it's three rounds of booze with various people. And so I did this thing where I drank three rounds of cocktails with the younger cast members of Top Gun Maverick. Mm. So to be clear, not Tom Cruise or Jennifer Connelly, but the actors who played the fighter pilots. And,
yes.
And it was one of those things at the very last minute, the video director and producer are like, you're on camera for this, right?
Well, you're staggering about and falling over.
It was also that you got to think, I was interviewing six people who were like Hollywood actors. So, pretty easy on the eye and with a 1% body fat ratio. But I'd also spent all this time training for the movie and so on and so forth.
Yeah.
And then there's me in a sort of...
The bronzed Adonis of South Wales.
Yes. At the end. And I was kind of, with the body you might expect. Someone with a body wasn't that great before they sat indoors for 2 years. So I was a bit mortified by that. And I was a bit nervous. And actually, the wonderful thing about this is that because of editing, you barely see me at all, which is fantastic. But I do remember at one point they got very rowdy, and I was trying to be the voice of authority, and they'd been talking about, how they'd actually gone up in jets and stuff. And to my horror, I found myself saying, look, I'm, several decades older than these characters. I was like, look, I was flying two-man chipmunks out of Filton Air Base in the CCF when I was at school before you bastards were even born. And then I was like, can we cut that out? Can you cut that out, right? Which they must have.
See you out, Top Gun, nice one. Right, okay, we want some official entertainment and snap reactions from you. Ryan Gosling as Ken in the Barbie movie.
The picture sort of intrigued me, I have to say. I just don't know what kind of film this is going to be. This is Margot Robbie's playing Barbie, and it's sort of, and she's a pretty interesting character. Barbie herself is quite interesting for various reasons, but Margot Robbie's, no fool. And I just don't know whether this is something that is going to be for me or not, in the sense of, is it going to be just a Barbie and Ken movie, or is it going to be a hilarious, takedown of Barbie and Ken in some fashion?
Yeah, it's knocking them off the pedestal from where they've ruled with impunity for so many decades.
He's a good looking fellow.
He is a good looking fellow.
Ryan Gosling, I have to say.
The Joker, the musical, which is apparently happening.
Seeing the Joker, it just wasn't for me. I had to have three vodkas before seeing it because I knew what kind of experience it would be. And then I had to have four vodkas afterwards. And almost no fault on the film, really. But it was, I did not enjoy seeing that film. I don't know what a musical version of that would be like. But
it would be with songs.
I'd be looking forward more to the Ken and Barbie movie.
Okay, fair enough. And finally, Russell T. Davis bringing back two monsters from the first issue of Doctor Who Weekly in 1979. They've only ever been seen there. This is a deep cut even by my pathetic standards.
Do we know what they are?
They are. You'll know these, Clark. Beep the Meep and the Wrath Warriors.
All for it. Russell T. Davis can do no harm. Can do nothing wrong in my book. I feel like such a fool because I interviewed Russell T 18 months ago, just as a sort of retrospective article about the first ever kind of Doctor Who Christmas special.
Mm.
And the one question I didn't ask, and I would usually ask this, and he wouldn't have given an answer, but at no point did it occur to me to say, hey, are you going to come back to write some more Doctor Who? I wanted to talk about this later, but seeing David Tennant and Neil Patrick Harris caper around via Twitter on the streets of Bristol this week has been making me very happy.
It warmed your little hearts.
Mm-hmm.
Before we move on, a reminder. You know what the most exciting thing is about supporting the Culture Bunker on Patreon? Not only do you know how to use the Internet of Things, but you can impress your friends. Even more than that, you can get all our shows early and without adverts because sometimes they get in the way, especially the ones for mattresses. That means daily episodes on politics, science, pop culture and much more, plus all manner of exciting merch and special shows just for you because we like you. Just search Patreon Bunker Podcast to find out more.
First up, TV. If you are jonesing for some Marvel content since Moon Knight ended, Go on, you know you are. Then your pangs are over with the arrival of Ms. Marvel to Disney+. Kamala Khan is Marvel's first Pakistani-American hero, a 16-year-old girl from Jersey City whose love of Carol Danvers, a.k.a. Captain Marvel, do you see, leads her to neglect her studies, spend all her time on cosplay, and generally not be a dutiful daughter. Crack on, Kamala. With a largely Asian cast and also Asian writing and directing team, it's a far cry from rich white guys in powered armor, a fact which has inevitably enraged several thousand middle-aged blokes who've been giving it one-star reviews on IMDb for being woke. But what will we think of it? Here is a taster.
Okay, so first off, I just want to say, I get it.
You get what?
High school.
Kamala.
Kamala.
Another adventure shirt. Cute.
Maybe they're right. I spend too much time in fantasy land.
That is not you.
It's not really the brown girls from Jersey City who save the world.
Did something happen to you?
No, why? Did you hear something?
Kamala?
What does it feel like?
Cosmic. I always thought I wanted this kind of life. But I never imagined any of this.
Do you even know what you are?
I'm a superhero.
Colleen Cosmo Murphy, how Marvel are you?
I am not very Marvel.
Ah, in which case, what did you think of this?
I enjoyed it. I thought it was really good. As you said, you know, there's the first time you have a female Muslim character as a superhero. And I think the fact that it's taking place in America is a great thing, considering the Islamophobia that's taken place over the last two decades. I think it's going to be a great thing for young people to watch. In terms of, will I watch it again? Perhaps not. If it's on, of course I would. I thought it was a great opening episode, and I think it's a great project that they're doing. I like the fact that behind the scenes, it's mainly people from Asian heritage.
British Asian, American
British
Asian,
Asian
and heavily female as well.
Yeah, oh, fantastic. That's good to know. I didn't even realize that. But I thought it was really great. It's just not the kind of thing that I normally watch. I think Clark will probably have a lot more things to say about it than me.
I mean, there is a whole load of meta going on in here. Kamala is a huge fan of the Avengers in her universe, as if they are rock stars, as if they are... You know, the first episode revolves around Avengers Con, where she's supposedly going to go. And in the classic teenage movie thing, strict mom and dad won't let you go there. And I just love the spin on that. It's as if the show is made for people like her who grew up on the MCU movies. What did you make of Iman Vellani as Kamala herself?
Oh, she was fantastic. And, you know, it's just watching it, you remember the brutality that teenagers can inflict upon one another. And she seems to have this kind of positive spirit and is somewhat of an optimist, trying to make friends with people despite how they're treating her. And she did a great job with that, I thought.
I like the fact that it's basically a classic comics wallflower. She's basically Peter Parker, except as a 16-year-old Asian girl instead of a skinny, like, 16-year-old white boy. Clark, this is very much your beat. What did you think?
I really liked a lot of it. I mean, the cast was terrific. So one of the conceits is that she's got like a huge imagination and you sort of see that they literalize that on camera. So you have, as you say, they're going to AvengerCon. She's going to cosplay as Ms. Marvel, as Captain Marvel. And her and a friend are walking along the street and there, but she wants to make a mashup costume. So that talking about, will it be like Doctor Strange Marvel, or will it be Zombie Marvel? And as she's, as they're talking about the different suggestions, these sort of illustrations appear on the wall, which I thought was absolutely terrific. I will say it's kind of Scott Pilgrim-y, the whole thing. They've clearly sort of borrowed a little bit from Scott Pilgrim versus the World. I loved the fact that they show cricket at one point. I don't think you can ever overemphasize the possibility that Americans might eventually get into cricket. And I have to say, there was a moment, as you say, there was a moment that really touched me, or broke my heart, really, in a way that like half the things in the world disappearing in the Avengers didn't. When, as you say, so she wants to go to AvengerCon. Her parents aren't keen, but her parents come up with this plan whereby the daughter and the father will go as Hulks, basically. Mm-hmm. They've got a Hulk costume for her, and then he dresses up as Hulk and sort of, you know, is painted green. And then they unveil this plan to her, and he sort of jumps in through the door dressed as Hulk, and they assume she'll be delighted. But of course, somewhat predictably, she's mortified by this idea, and it clearly breaks their heart.
Yeah.
And I was just sitting there being like, this is awful. I mean, this is just, you know, in the way that they want us to be.
Yeah.
I was like, oh no, this is like, and it just makes me, I don't know, as I get older, I kind of think how much my own parents, you know, went out on a limb to support me and how I would sort of just routinely throw it back in their faces. And I thought, I mean, not the lead character is a mean character, and certainly I can empathize with not wanting to go to Comic-Con with your parents. Actually, I'd quite like to go to Comic-Con with my parents.
I would now.
Yes.
I'd love it now. Going when I was 16, no, but now would be just fantastic and awesome. What is great about it, I think, is that there's not actually an awful lot of super action in this. It's a family comedy.
Right.
It is like, here is the world of, it's an Asian family in Jersey City, with everything that goes with that, and people who never really appear on screen, seen through the lens of Marvel. But what it's really about is controlling mom and dad trying to keep a lid on things. And I just found it really heartwarming.
Well, yeah, and her powers, I mean, she doesn't really get any powers until right at the end. And there's also no antagonist that I could, I mean, maybe the antagonist
End of episode two is the first time we get an antagonist, which I think is quite a bold move.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I mean, by then you're sort of a movie's length into it, you know. I mean, I grew up, you know, with Judge Dredd, and then all those sort of British comics artists that took a lot of, you know, square-jawed American superheroes and filled them with pus and awfulness. And that's sort of more my thing. I mean, while watching Miss Marvel, I was simultaneously watching The Boys, and The Boys is, frankly, very much more my speed. Mm. But you can't criticize something for not being, you know, the thing.
Something else.
Yes. Yeah. So, yeah, Sean, I'm all for it.
Sean, what did you think?
I think it's interesting, and I'm very, very much behind it. But the fact that I think to placate an American audience, they've got to make it so mainstream and they've got to make her so cute. She's an update on a Disney princess. There's not that much difference between them. She's not necessarily a superhero at the start. They're playing it very soft and easy. That makes it more difficult for me to actually get into it because there are no rough edges on the first episode. And I've done 1.5 now. And I think you are getting the glimpses of that coming through. But the cleverness and the wit of it hasn't quite come through yet because they're still saying, look, it's fine to have her as the lead character. She's fantastic, though. She looks like she looks like Bambi, as I say, the update of Bambi and a Disney princess sort of meld into one. She looks incredible, but I wanted a bit more edge. But then I'm saying the same as Clark and Colleen, really, is it's not for that. It has a different function, and it's really, really good that they've put it out now.
One of our listeners, Chris Howard, heard an ad for this on the podcast and thought it was Miss Marple. Says, I would love the Marvel Cinematic Universe's Miss Marple would be accepted.
Well, they might bring in. Yeah. She might solve some cases.
Yeah. I have a suspicion that the darkness is going to start coming through because the way she gets her powers is intimately connected to, you know, a disappeared family member and the partition of India and the deaths of many, many people. So I think there's a bit of grit there somewhere that may
pay out. Well, like WandaVision, which took you in one direction, you thought, well, why is this still going? And then the clues start making sense. Mm. And then the Easter eggs at such. And, oh, I see what it's trying to do within that universe. I'm presuming that that will happen with this one here. So they've only put two out now, haven't they? Because it's weekly.
Yeah. Do sort of review bombing pylons like the one that Miss Marvel is getting have any real effect, do you think? I mean, it's been well received by critics everywhere. And yet it's got a 6.6 rating on IMDb with loads of one-star reviews all saying the same thing, which is basically this is woke because the characters in it are not white.
But is that Mr. Angry of Pearly,
etc.
Well, I don't really ever read those ones because I think they're the fly-by-night ones and Marvel is not going to stand on whether a couple of people think that it's too self-consciously politically correct.
What does in-house Marvel expert Fred think about it?
He wasn't keen.
Really?
So I think that's quite a good barometer. So we see all Marvel, and we have been seeing all Marvel for the last 6-7 years. And he has his favourites, and we sat down to watch it together. And I think because of the cutie girly aspect, but we weren't that sold on WandaVision, and then he went and, you know, he binged all of it at one point. So I think it might be similar for that. Might try and put it on again for
Did he like Doctor Strange?
Oh, he loves Doctor Strange.
I cried during Doctor Strange. Just to be clear, I was Sam Raimi. When he got really Sam Raimi, when the Dutch angles like sort of started flying. Not because of Marvel, I just wept because Sam Raimi was back.
He's
it made
back.
Me so happy.
Yes,
but we're Guardians of the Galaxy round our way. So I was just waiting. When's it coming out? When's it coming out, Clark? When's it coming out?
I think it's next year.
Oh,
sorry.
One thing.
Apologies to Marvel.
Can't you make it quicker, Clark? Surely you have connections.
I have to tick one box for this for exceptional performances. In episode 2, there's a bit where her mate Nakia decides to run for the mosque council, which is essentially a kind of...
bit in the mosque is great, though. Yeah. That scene actually should be said when they actually mention the separation of women and men. I just thought that's really brave. Some of the stuff's really good.
Well, it's a transposing of the traditional, I'm running for high school president, except it's not high school, it's a mosque. Yeah. So they have to go and work the crowd at a celebration and identify all the little cliques. And the clique that's got power is the Illumin aunties, all the aunties who are really in charge of everything. And I thought that was, there's more levels of meta there than there. I felt like I got my Disney Plus subscription worth on that. I'm enjoying it. I'm gonna keep watching it. But then, frankly, Marvel could make, the Marvel Universe's, guide to home maintenance, and I'd watch that, wouldn't I? I am uncritical. Now, who's up for a Balearic breakfast? That's the title of the mind-massaging new compilation put together by our guest, Colleen Cosmo Murphy. Balearic Breakfast Volume 1, out now on Heavenly Records. It's an hour and more of cosmically calming inner ear music, inspired by her Worldwide FM show and featuring remixes by artists including Ashley Beadle, the late and much-loved Andrew Weatherall, and Colleen herself. We're going to be talking about it and life as a globally transcendent sound explorer after this track from the album. This is Vapor by Marred Life, Colleen's Cosmodelica remix. Killian, what's a Balearic breakfast? Is it when the eggs float off under their own steam and the bacon is waving at you?
Something like that. Hmm. I started Balearic Breakfast as a radio show during the pandemic. I had been filling in for Giles Peterson on Worldwide FM on Tuesday mornings. In the summer, temporarily, I had a show called Summer Staycation. It's when many of us were locked in our homes and weren't going anywhere. I didn't go anywhere on holiday like most people, I think, in the UK. And you had to kind of have a staycation. But then Giles said, just keep the show, actually. It's doing really well. So when September came around, I realized I couldn't call it Summer Staycation anymore. So I put the word out to my listeners, hey, looking for a new show title. And somebody, a friend of mine, my friend Lee Z, came back and said, how about Balearic Breakfast? And I really liked it because it's kind of has an association with music that is somehow transcendental and allowing you to escape your immediate surroundings. And it's also not a specific genre of music, so it's all encompassing, which is one of my favorite parts of the show.
Well, I've got a mate who's big into this stuff, and we go to him for Balearic adjudications. This record, is it Balearic or not? And he'd say, yes, it is. No, it isn't. What's your definition? Because the listeners need to know this.
Well, it's kind of like trying to define jazz, which is very hard to define because it encompasses so many different types of sounds. I think originally you could say, oh, it's music that was played on the Balearic Islands, mainly in the 1970s and 80s when DJs started playing in clubs and restaurants. And there's a few different types of sounds. You have the Balearic beat, which is more pop and dance and something danceable for the dance floor. And then he had more chill out kind of sounds a la Café Del Mar, where José Padilla was a resident and he did all those great compilations in the 1990s. I mean, I do feel a bit funny being an American hosting a show called Balearic Breakfast because, I mean, honestly, the only reference I'd ever heard to Ibiza was in Life on Mars, David Bowie singing about the Norfolk Broads. I couldn't have pointed to it on a map until the 1990s, until the Café Del Mar album started coming out. But I have a very probably different approach. So I try to do what is traditionally called Balearic, whether it's the chill out side or the dance side. but making it even more all-encompassing music that I feel takes you to another time and place and space. And that could be anything from jazz to, I've even played classical, contemporary classical on the show before.
Well, there's a track on this, actually, I think it's actually the very first track, but I've never encountered this before, but Joan Biblioni, who appears to be a kind of Spanish Vinnie Riley of Derussi Column, and she's like 70 and doing this.
Yeah.
I thought it was Joe. Oh, I was in Joanna.
Joan Biblioni.
There you go. You see,
from Mallorca.
That's how little I knew about this. So he is like 70. Tell us about him.
Well, he's my only proper Balearic musician on there, and I'm glad that he's leading the way. He, I believe, started in the 1980s as a guitarist and composer, and he's been making music, some of it self-released. Not a huge, huge following, but what a beautiful, beautiful records that he's put out. And he's that's been a recent interest in his work with different reissues of his albums and compilations. This song that I put on as the opening song, Safaska, is just a beautiful, you know, completely dreamy, chilled out. So I like how you described him as almost like a Balearic Vinnie Riley from Derussi Column. Very, very similar sound. And I'm glad that there's at least one Balearic musician on there.
So you learned your trade and cut your teeth at The Loft with the great David Mancuso, a legendary DJ. How did you come to be the Robin to his Balearic Batman?
Okay, well, I was already DJing before I met David. I'd been on the radio for several years and had done some, you know, played out as a DJ because of college radio, you know, doing nights at different places in New York City. But when I went to David Mancuso's Loft party, which was a private party in his home at that point on 3rd Street between Avenues B and C in Alphabet City in New York City, I went in about 91, 92, and I was just transformed. It was kind of like Alice in Alice in Wonderland falling down the hole and like coming into this space that had absolutely no information on the outside. He was a legend. I mean, he started his parties in his home in 1970 based on the Harlem Rent parties, and they became the foundation for club culture as we know it.
Now, these listeners will probably not know what a rent party was. So explain a rent party.
Okay, when a lot of African Americans migrated from the South to New York City and to the North to get jobs in the early 1920s, they weren't really allowed to go to any clubs as such. So in Harlem, especially, a lot of people, it's kind of like the Blues and Shabeen's parties, Shabeen parties here in the UK, where they would open their own doors and play music and have, you know, drinks, and people would pay a contribution at the door. So it helped them pay their rent and have a good time and party with their own communities. So it was very much based on that kind of philosophy. And David was a huge supporter of civil rights, a huge supporter of women's liberation, gay liberation, and started throwing parties in his own home in Greenwich Village as early as 1968, but unofficially. And then in 1970, on the 14th of February, Valentine's Day, he opened his doors and started a party called Love Saves a Day as a weekly party on a Saturday night. He did a lot for the culture because he also won a landmark case with the Department of Consumer Affairs in the early 1970s. They wanted to shut him down. But because he didn't sell alcohol and it was a private party, he was able to stay open, which kind of made a whole ruling for all of the private members clubs that followed in you know, after the Loft.
There you go, listeners. Tips on how to pay your rent. Just launch a legendary Loft party in your own home. Now, you've been running Classic Album Sundays for like, it's since like 2010, isn't it? Now, it's a long time. Obviously, had to go into hibernation a bit during lockdown. What's in just 12 and more years of doing this? What are the sessions that really stand out where you learned things about these albums? Because you've done loads of them now.
Yeah. Well, actually, just to say, we didn't go into hibernation. We just went online, and it's actually gotten stronger.
Thing,
So we have a Patreon as well with our album club, our monthly album club, and pub quiz online. The best guess, it's so hard because there's so many different types of music. Julian Cope is always a wonderful person to interview because you have to stay on your toes. The first time I think I interviewed him was back in the early 90s for Peggy's Suicide, and I've interviewed him for Six Music as well. But I did a live event with him at the John Peel Center, which was just amazing because he's just so out there and his brain works so quickly and it just goes to all these other places. You really have to be on your toes. And I was really complimented by his wife, also an American, who said, wow, you were really good. You're the only person who's really been able to handle Julian in a live situation. He was wonderful. There's so many. John Grant is another great one, just because we're so much alike and same age and both American living in Europe and have a very similar musical background. And he's just such a real person, like completely 100% real, no artifice at all. He wears his heart on his sleeve. I loved interviewing Jazzy B for Club Classics Volume 1 from Soul to Soul's classic album. He was on fire. We did a great event at the British Library. There's been so many. I've been so lucky. I think the one that probably wowed me the most was interviewing Nick Mason.
Yeah.
From Pink Floyd, and doing that as part of the V&A Museum's exhibition, Their Immortal Remains. Being able to do that was like, wow, when I started Classic Album Sundays in my friend's pub in 2010, I had no idea that I'd be sitting here a few years later with Nick Mason talking about one of the most classic albums of all time.
The next one you've got up is Miles Davis's Sketches of Spain on the 29th of June. I'm amazed you haven't done that already.
I know, me too. I'm a huge Miles Davis fan. This is for our online album club. Yeah. And in a sense, we're able to go a little bit deeper. So, because we're not putting bums on seats, you know, and selling tickets. There's just people who have a membership and they come along to the album club on Zoom. And I also record the presentations to send out to the members who are unable to join at that time. Miles is one of my favorite musicians of all time. I mean, I don't think I'm alone in saying that. But Sketches in Spain is an album that just brings me somewhere else. And I said to the members, let's do an album based around summer holidays. And I nominated that one. So, you know, we do a vote. And I kind of felt a little guilty that mine actually won, because Sketches of Spain does bring me right down to Andalusia with its opening notes. It's just an amazing album.
What would you love to do, but you haven't done yet?
Oh, gosh, there's so many different people. I mean, of course, I mean, who wouldn't want to interview Paul McCartney? You know, I mean, he's one hero I would like to interview. There's some heroes you don't want to interview, like Van Morrison. Astral Weeks is one of my favorite albums of all time. And Joni Mitchell as well, I have to say. She's one of my favorite artists of all time, too. But I think I'd be too scared to interview her. But Paul McCartney seems like he's a bit more gentle. And I would love to interview him sometime. I don't know if that will ever happen, but I'm just putting that out there.
You never know. Well, we understand he's an avid listener, so it definitely will happen. later in the show, we're going to be forcing both of our guests to choose the single greatest album ever. So maybe one or two suggestions will come from there.
Certainly. Now, every week we ask our guests to bring in a current favourite track of theirs as a service to our faithful listeners. Clark Collis, what is yours and why do you love it?
My track is Falling Apart Right Now from the album Cruel Country by the mighty Wilco, who are most definitely one of my favourite bands. This is sort of the first album they've done. It's not the first album they've done in a while, but I believe it's the first album that where they've sort of been in a room together, bashing it out. It's just wonderful.
2, 3, 4. Now don't you fall apart while I'm falling apart. Why don't you get in line behind the tears I'm crying? I know our hearts aren't very smart, but you're gonna have to learn when it isn't your turn somehow. 'Cause I'm gonna be the only one falling apart right now.
Now, onto TV and We Own This City. It tells the true story of police corruption in Baltimore after the death in police custody of Freddie Gray in 2015. We Own This City is made by David Simon and George Pelicanos, whose fictional series The Wire, of course, was also set in Baltimore and ran from 2002 to 2008. So why tread the same ground? Why cast some of the same actors from The Wire? And what more is there to say about police brutality and systemic corruption? Turns out, let's listen to the trailer.
Señor Pablo Escobar is the police.
In a war, you need warriors.
On the ground, get down on the ground!
You have enemies. In a war, civilians get hurt and nobody does anything. In a war, you count the bodies
and then you call them victories.
The series centres, of course, around the death of Freddie Gray, as mentioned, and the subsequent setting up of the Baltimore Police Department low-profile gun trace task force. Sounds like that's going to go well, everybody. Clark, you live in the States. Do you remember the Freddie Gray event, first off?
Yes, I do. Although, you know, over the last few years, it's been hard to keep track of one, you know, atrocity after another. It was interesting to watch this with, in the same week as watching Miss Marvel, just because of, you know, with Miss Marvel, you still, even though it's pretty sharp and you know, it looks great, you do feel you're sort of being spoon-fed the story a little bit. Mm. And there is like a part of my brain that's like, come on, let's get to the bit where, you know, buildings are being demolished or what have you. Mm. This, We Own This City, on the other hand, within 10 minutes, I was like, oh, I'm going to really have to concentrate here. I'm going to have to put on my big boy viewing pants and really, you know, turn every computer off and try to figure out what's going on, because it throws you in there. It's got, I think, three timelines, maybe more. And early on, I was like, I mean, one of the stars is John Bernthal, who plays this corrupt cop. And you're introduced to him early on. You can tell, oh, well, in this timeline, he's got this bad haircut. Mm. And in this other timeline, the bad haircut has grown out a bit, but now he's got an awful mustache. And you're like, okay, if I keep hold of John Bernthal's different hair, then that'll be fine. And then the bugger disappears for like almost the entire first episode. So I was totally lost I wasn't totally lost at sea. But it's funny, I was watching it with our, you know, mutual friend Jane, who had seen the first episode before and was nice enough to rewatch it with me. I mean, we ended up watching the whole thing. But she kept on, when she was rewatching the first episode, she kept on saying, oh, I see. Oh, I see. I get that. Oh, that's quite funny. You know, it really does demand your attention. I don't know if they needed to sort of slice it up in this fashion. On the other hand, I was gripped, and we watched the whole thing in 2 nights, I think.
Wow. Did you watch The Wire originally?
Yes. And funnily enough, I was at home with my mum this week and was sort of in between doing various things, rewatching bits of The Wire. Which now
this is what you say to your mum on a quiet night. Should we watch something about brutal gang murders and the drug trade in Baltimore?
Well, she's a great lady. She says fine. Yeah.
Well, she's more of a Sopranos fan, really. But it's funny how now, I mean, The Wire was so groundbreaking because of its, you know, vast landscape and the fact that it was very much not like a crime of the week, and these storylines would go on and be told in tiny little snippets. But watching that now, it seems relatively conventional compared to what it looked like at the time. Plus, I have to say, either Baltimore has gotten much worse, or David Simon's and George Pelicanos, the executive producers there, view of the world has become more pessimistic, because watching The Wire now, you're like, okay, so if they could only get rid of a couple of bad apples and make the policing, sort of shift the emphasis in policing, you know, tactics, then maybe things could work out. Whereas We Own This City is it's just like, this is terrible, and things can only get worse.
Well, as you know, it's based on a book which was written by a journalist who worked for the Baltimore Sun, who saw all this as it happened. Andrew, I presume you've watched The Wire. How different is this? And Clark is saying it.
It is. Although the setting and many of the faces are the same, certainly the themes are the same, it is very different, I think, and not for the better. The Wire, I remember watching the first three episodes of The Wire and thinking, what in the hell is going on here? I have no idea. I'm completely lost at sea. And then episode four, it all clicked and I was completely hooked. It is the original slow burn where commitment is repaid. And the reason commitment is repaid is that The Wire is stuffed with fantastic characters. It's stuffed with brilliant anti-heroes, compelling villains, fantastic multi-dimensional, nuanced characters who you care about, even though you know many of them are sending themselves straight to hell. I really didn't get that at all from We Own This City, possibly because there's a limited series of six, it doesn't have time to go into those characters. Mm-hmm. But worse than that, it didn't seem to actually show a great deal of interest in those characters. Bernthal's character, Officer Wayne Jenkins, is a kind of like, hey, you guys, what are you doing? Sort of like, you know, a very bouncy, very kind of alpha male, you know, a guy who's clearly, you know, 2 seconds from going off the leash and committing crimes himself. Mm. But we don't really get much more depth than that. And very few of the other characters, you know, compared to the experience with The Wire where, you know, Bubbles and Omar and, you know, all the cops, yeah, you know, you yeah. felt they had an interiority. And these guys, you know, it demands attention, but I honestly don't think it repays it very much.
Oh, Colleen.
I loved it, actually. Yeah. I'm a huge fan of The Wire, and I had so much empathy for all of the characters on whatever side. I think, of course, in 6 episodes, it is very difficult to develop that same kind of a relationship with the character. And I agree with Clark that it takes a while to actually figure out what's going on. I think it was episode 3 where everything started to fall into place. Mm. But I did think that there was a lot of depth of character that was revealed over the course of the 6 episodes, including with Wayne Jenkins. I mean, you can clearly see he's a narcissist. Mm. He can't even help himself. He actually believes what he's actually saying when he's saying it. He doesn't think he did anything wrong. And I think there is quite a bit of that probably throughout the police force. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think it addresses an issue that's, and I agree as well, The Wire is almost seems a bit more optimistic in a sense than We Own This City, because when We Own This City came out, we're talking, this is post-George Floyd and all the other killings, mm-hmm. I mean, that have been going on for decades and decades and decades in the United States, especially with policemen killing black males. Mm. But this, I think, shows that it's institutional. The fact that the person from the Department of Justice, is it Nicole Steele, I think is the character's
Nicole
name,
Steele,
and she's actually not a real life character. She's a composite of different characters. She's trying to unlock why this keeps happening, and you find out that it's institutional. Mm. And, you know, you see the police commissioner who you think's trying to do the right thing, and I think in his head he is trying to do the right thing. And you see also, I think for me, the African-American cops and how they kind of fall into playing along with the crimes that are committed and led by the white cops. Mm. And doing it in a sense where they're almost, I mean, I don't want, everyone's accountable for their actions, but, you know, it's a little more difficult, I think, for them to stand up to a white cop to say, I'm not going to do that. Mm-hmm. You know, yeah. I mean, how that would probably affect their career and how they would be promoted. So for me, I think there was a lot of empathy for a lot of the characters, maybe a couple there wasn't at all. And I thought it was great. It was 6 episodes. I binge watched it as well. And this is the kind of drama that I love, things that are based on historic truths.
Mm. Mm. Fantastic. We must mention the credits, which do blur what we're seeing on screen and the actors and also some of the real life footage. Yeah. And this incredible bass. So if you are lucky to have a subwoofer with your soundbar on your TV, as some of us are, the bass is so high on this and it just sounds like people in cars passing by playing whatever music. It is incredible. I think it's really beautifully designed. I absolutely loved it. I can't claim that I'm understanding every single bit, and I'll probably go back and watch it. I'm on 2.5. Mm. But I was reading with David Simon some of the stuff he was talking about, and the fact that some of those Wire characters have been put in the cast, usually in a polar opposite side, is about the way that it's systemic, it's not about personality, that actually it is interchangeable, and We Own This City being such a clever title. Mm. That says it all, and about a system which pits everyone in the same playground, as it were, and we're all the same, police and thieves. I mean, it's so good and it's so rich. Yeah, I really, really lapped it up. As I say, I did have to rewind some bits, because if you just start, you know, if your phone does ping or you just think, I'll go and have a cup of tea, you do have to pause, rewind and check what's going on. Also, we were saying it is quite thick Baltimore, US. I don't know about you. You two are used to US accents. Us Brits were fine.
Well, it didn't bother me because I now have no intention of going to Baltimore. So, so the fact that I can't necessarily understand what anybody's saying is neither here nor there. I will say, as a sort of postscript, that watching The Wire at your mum's house on Sky is interesting, because Idris Elba is also the pitch man for Sky. Mm. So you're watching Idris Elba committing terrible crimes, and then it's the adverts, and he's like, "Hey, why don't you,
get more Sky."
I love The Wire too, absolute fan. But I imagine that looks completely staged compared to this. Yeah, I would really recommend this. I think Andrew's looking slack.
I'm persevering with it. It's just I felt that it was like The Wire with all my favorite bits of The Wire stripped away.
I think it's conceptual. It's because it's more conceptual and it's meant to be difficult, and they've just screwed that chronological order. You can't get out of this mess.
That's true.
How it feels.
Yeah, I mean, I find
how do you unravel it?
I found the chronological slicing and dicing needlessly obfuscatory. It doesn't gain anything.
I thought it did, actually. Because then one of the characters in the beginning, who you'd think is playing a minor part, ends up becoming probably the most significant character at the end. I don't want to say who that is, because for listeners that haven't yet watched the show.
I think it was the penultimate episode I was watching with our friend Jane, and there was a point, and I said, is this happening now? And she said, yes. And I said, what, now? And she was like, no. And I knew by that point, I knew exactly what she meant.
Then now.
That would be crazy. It's then now.
Let's have another tune. Killeen, you're going to choose one for us now. What would that be?
Well, recently this week, I had a request on my Balearic Breakfast show for this really great pop song, very independent, Lapel Records, I believe they're called, L-E-P-E-L. And the song was by Carion. It's called Captive. And I played it on my Balearic Breakfast show. And it's just such an amazing, amazing song. So I'm encouraging people to go out and find that. But I'm going to do a self-promotional plug. And I recently remixed Hard Feelings, which is a project by Joe Goddard from Hot Chip, and Amy Douglas, who's a singer from Brooklyn, who's worked with Roisin Murphy and Horsemeat Disco. And together they are called Hard Feelings. And they asked me to do a remix of one of their songs, Love Scenes. And I did kind of a throwback house mix that's kind of akin to the Def Mix remixes by Frankie Knuckles and David Morales, and it's out on Domino Recordings now.
Here we go then. Hard Feelings with Love Scenes, Cosmodelica Mix.
We finish with a bit more music, with the news that it's the 40th anniversary of a certain album by a certain British pop band, and Andrew subsequently dancing on the table and putting it on repeat as he would, we thought we must delve where we rarely delve. We often ask about the best song ever, but what will our guests and ourselves proffer up when it comes to the greatest album of all time? What will we choose? Obviously, the man is saying a massive no to clearing our choices, but we'll put them on the playlist. The choices are What's Going On by Marvin Gaye, Exile on Main Street by The Rolling Stones, The Lexicon of Love by ABC, and Hijira, chosen obviously by a massive hippie in the room somewhere. Cosmo, let's start with you, as I call you now. What have you gone for? Which one of those was yours?
Well, oh my gosh, I could have said Hijira. And it's always like that's in my top 10, and they're kind of swimming around in there. But yeah, I'm the one that chose What's Going On.
Mm-hmm. And
I think it's
why?
Wonderful.
Yeah.
This album came out in 1971, and both Marvin Gaye's story at that time is so interesting, how Motown didn't want to put it out. And in fact, you know, Berry Gordy said when he heard What's Going On, it was the worst song ever. But these themes also we can still relate to today. And the other thing I love about this album is it's universally known. So many of us can sing the entire album without even knowing that the lyrics are stored in our head. So with its themes, with what was going on with the artist at that time, standing up for his own creativity, and it becoming one of the biggest albums of all time, and just for its musicality and its popularity, that's the reason why I'm going for that one.
Is it perfect, though? Are there any songs you'd lop off?
Nope, it's perfect. It's a sweet. It's actually one piece of music to me.
Ah, good answer. Any other standout tracks?
I mean, all of the. In fact, it's the entire album consumed as a whole.
Right.
Like, there's Inner City Blues. I mean, that's a great song, but it is the whole thing as one piece of music that really, really makes me say it's one of the best albums.
Mm-hmm. Now, it's probably rare that any of our listeners have never listened to this album, but they may not have listened to it for a while. Give us your 1-minute pitch about why they should put it on this weekend.
Marvin Gaye's What's Going On addressed themes in 1971 that are still going on today. Themes about environmental degradation, being overtaxed, war, pollution. I mean, there's so many different themes that go in there. Interestingly enough, he never speaks about race on the album. He said he wanted it to be listened to by everybody. But of course, this is coming from a Black American man, and it, that would, you know, his perspective, of course, would encompass that anyways. Race, of course, is a big topic right now as well. So in a sense, it does sort of address it because he's talking about his cousin, I think, happened to be in the Vietnam War. A lot of young Black men went off to war in Vietnam, and he's thinking about that experience as well. It's musically incredible. He did a different thing with his vocals. He started to sing quieter, closer to the microphone, which he ended up doing for the rest of the 1970s and his other classic albums, which had a very, very different feel,
yeah,
more along the romantic tip.
Yeah, yeah.
And also great string arrangements as well, just beautifully well put together.
Very good. Collis, I wonder what you chose.
I did indeed choose Exile on Main Street. Although I have to say, as a teenager, I spent many, many hours feeling sad and listening to Hajira. So that is a great choice. It's funny you were saying, you know, what's perfect about the Marvin Gaye album? And in a sense, there's nothing perfect about Exile on Main Street. That's sort of its appeal.
Yeah.
I mean, it's just this shambling, you know, to album masterpiece made by the Stones. I mean, it's what I've always been a Stones guy and not a Beatles guy, and feel obliged for some reason to continue waging a war that no one's cared about.
Yeah, because the Stones need
50,
your help,
right?
They need
50
a bit of support
years
from you. They're not selling many tickets at the moment.
And I have to say, being in America, it's so much fun when someone mentions the Beatles, and I'm like, nah, I just don't like them. And you can tell. You can tell that they don't know what to do,
yes,
because they can hear my accent. And so they're like, well, he's from the land of the Beatles. But and yet he's not saying, so, I mean, yes, the Beatles has a few good tunes. But
Why should everyone listen to this, Clark? Why? This weekend, should they be sticking
it on? Is just one, even though you wouldn't, you know, use the word banger about any of them, I don't think. It is one. I mean, starting with Tumbling Dice, it is just one great track after another of absolute kind of consistency. As I said earlier, I mean, I've got other favorite albums, but usually there's a track on there where you're
something,
like, oh, I'm not too sure about this. Or it's just like, you know, totally out of sync with the rest of the album. And I just think, you know, this is just a perfect encapsulation of the band, even though, I mean, there is this sort of myth around the album that they, for tax reasons, you know, all went and lived in the south of France and recorded this album in a house, which to some extent is true. But when you more read up about it, I mean, they did record it in little tiny bits, you know, all over the world. But, you know, it's Mick and Keith, and they're sort of, for the time, experimental early 70s. Pomp before, you know, Keith got overly devoured by drugs. And
the songs got flabbier, didn't they? But this is...
A little bit. I mean, it is. I mean, you know, this is a sort of... They do have this golden run of Sticky Fingers and Exile on Main Street and all really all through the 70s and up to Tattoo You, really, which is... Actually, Tattoo You is sort of an album of outtakes from previous recordings, which is remarkable because that's a classic album in itself, even though it doesn't... You know, it's basically stuff they found down the back of the sofa. Mm-hmm. So you'd think it would be a lot of, you know, garbage, but it's absolutely fantastic. Sorry, I'm kind of like just filling up talking about Exile.
Exile's my favorite Stones album too.
Very,
it's an amazing
very
album.
Andrew, are you going to surprise us and tell us what you chose?
Well, it's going to be a huge surprise, and the reason we're doing this bit is because it's 40 years of the Lexicon of Love. This very, very month, 40 years since this fantastic, utterly perfect record came out.
I was listening to it this morning.
And
tell
it
us
sounds
why like
it was made yesterday, doesn't it? It's glittering, gorgeous, absolutely glorious record about love and all that goes with it, the ups, the downs, the hanging arounds. Four singles, but everything else could be a single as well. Even the little 90-second orchestral rearrangement of Look of Love at the end. Poison Arrow, Look of Love, All of My Heart. Tears Are Not Enough. Martin Fry in the pomp of his Baco foil suit glory. It sounds like Nelson Riddle made a record with Chic. It sounds like Rhapsody in Blue. Transported into Sheffield in the 1980s. It sounds like $100 million and was actually made in a studio slightly smaller than the table we're looking at right now. Absolutely everything is meticulous and yet still wild and abandoned. It's a Trevor Horn job, so course, every little yeah. squeak is choreographed and controlled. But to not to to sort of hammer it down and tamp it down, but to release its spirit, it just sounds amazing every single time. And on the rare occasions when I play records at parties, I won't pretend I'm a DJ. Colleen's a DJ. I just press play. Yes. But what you can stick, like, you can stick the Look of Love on, and the floor will fill, no matter how old the people in the room, no matter what the event. It is just, it is the apogee and the zenith of what pop music can do. And it was a close run thing with Dare by the Human League, but okay. I think Lexicon of Love edges it.
All right.
There you go. I've sold it to you.
Well, I quite liked it anyway.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's not a dreadful album.
I've sold it to Clark or something, because I'm sure, Cosmo, I'm sure you like it.
I love it. And it's part of the second British invasion and this, like, the, you know, my teenage years and Trevor Horn Productions. Yeah. And I just love it.
Have you ever classic album Sundays'd it?
I haven't done this one, but I have done, I did some Frankie Goes to Hollywood one with Trevor Horn and his whole team in SARS studio before they closed. And then Trevor played, it was at the opening notes of Poison Arrow, actually, on that same piano, and the hair stood up on my arm.
Well, a long time ago when this podcast was called Big Mouth, we had Anne Dudley in the studio.
Oh, she's
and
amazing.
She played on
she
our
played
wonky
the piano yeah. in the studio, and we all cried.
Yeah, Clark, have I sold it to you?
One, maybe. But two, people should go and listen to that Anne Dudley interview, because it was amazing and totally explained.
She was fantastic.
Like, what was going on, which I remember being quite confused about at the
yeah.
time.
Yeah, it's still in the archive.
Sean, what was yours?
Hajira.
Hajira. It had to be, because it was the only one left.
Why? Exactly.
Why?
It was the first thing that came to mind. And I agree with Colleen. I mean, one does have a sort of top 10 that just they change order at points. And I agree with Colleen. I hadn't realised it's not a collection of songs. It is one feeling divided into songs. And there is no album like it before or since. It speaks of liberation. It speaks of abandon. What she did was Joni Mitchell went on the road after Hissing of Summer Lawns and everything getting too much. She just went on the road. She wore a wig at points in New Orleans and stuff like that to hide herself and hung out with everybody and anybody and just lived these experiences because she needed to escape and she just split up with someone. And you can feel that, and it's a real experience. But musically, it's absolutely astounding. And she wrote differently because it was on the road. So she wrote instead of piano with guitar. It has this fretless bass. Now, normally fretless bass, I mean, you go,
it's Nina Paladino.
Yeah. But this is, and I probably pronounced it wrong, Jaco Pastorius.
Jaco
Pastorius. And it sings. And there's a lot of songs about the freedom of the road, obviously. There's a lot of songs about bird life and all sorts of things like that. And what the music does is they ape all of the atmospheres and allusions within the songs. It is just glorious. And it is a kind of, I used to make me feel quite miserable, and now it makes me feel really happy. I love it. I absolutely love it. It's just up there. And if you have not heard this record, then you haven't been alive.
to be clear, it didn't make me miserable. It was what I would listen to when I was miserable.
Well, there we go. And well, that's all I can say. It's just absolutely glorious, and I go back to it all the time.
We will obviously put selections from all of these albums onto the playlist. That is the end of the podcast. Thank you to Clark Collis for joining us.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
And thank you to Colleen Cosmo Murphy for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Please come again. Remember, listeners, you can get all the tunes on our rolling playlist on both Spotify and Tidal. The link is in the show notes. And before we go, regular listeners will remember last week, beer writer Pete Brown chose the fantastic new Altered Images single, Mascara Streaks, as his tune of the moment. We couldn't get it cleared in time to play, but now Claire Grogan says we can play it.
Yay.
So we're going to play out with the taster of Mascara Streaks. From me and Sean and producer Robin Leavern, thank you for listening. We'll see you next week. Here's Altered Images with Mascara Streaks.